versus Pierce case, have an opportunity to sign to have a large break. Ms. Padula Wilson, would you like to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 3 minutes, and it's just Ms. Wilson.
Ms. Wilson, all right. All right, Ms. Wilson, you have the 3 minutes for rebuttal, and you may begin when you're ready. And you're Ms. Caudill, right? All right, thank you.
Good morning. To go back to the other attorneys that spoke today, I have not been around forever. I'm relatively new, but I have been here before, as you all three of you know. As you already know, my name is Mandy Wilson, and I represent the appellant, Colleen Higgins. As the Supreme Court said in Nix versus Whiteside, the very nature of a trial is a search for truth. And today we're going to ask this court to grant a new trial because we believe when Ms. Higgins was not allowed to put on all of her evidence solely due to the court's time limitations, then the complete search for truth was not fully investigated, and Ms. Higgins did not get her full and fair de novo trial.
Ms. Wilson, help me to develop a line, and you might know that I was a trial judge once.
Yes.
And it's a trial judge's obligation and responsibility as a good trial judge to manage the trial.
Absolutely.
And no trial can go on forever.
That's true.
And I would venture to say that it is the practice of most trial judges to give counsel some limitations, because some lawyers, none in this room obviously, talk forever. So we need to make sure that there is an opportunity for everyone to get the case in a way that the judge can make a decision efficiently and proficiently and professionally. Mm-hmm. It appears that, based upon what we read in the record here, that you were dissatisfied with the limitations that were placed on your ability to put on your case. Where does your ability to put on your case end, and where does the judge's responsibility to control his or her docket begin?
Well, I was not the trial lawyer in this case. I simply took the appeal.
Right.
But I agree with you. In every case I've ever been involved in, there are limits to preserve judicial economy. Judges need to keep their trials moving. But there are limits to that. It's not an unlimited notion. And the limits are when there's a constitutional problem, for example, it's going to infringe on due process, then the court cannot use its arbitrary time limitations. Another example when it cannot use its arbitrary time limitations is when it's going to interfere with a fundamental right, such as the right to cross-examine a witness, which is what happened here.
But didn't the judge here in the trial, even though the time had expired, using the word that's the best word we can come up with at this point, even though the time for cross-examination expired, the judge said, I'm going to give you some time anyway, so do what you need to do.
Well, the judge did give 15 minutes to cross-examine one witness, the main witness, Mr. Pierce. But unfortunately, that was not a full and fair cross-examination. I think the case in Campbell versus Campbell, if they very clearly said, hey, the litigant can't necessarily control how much the opposing party is going to put on the other witness for on direct examination.
Was the evidence proffered here that, I know you were trial counsel, but mm-hmm. did trial counsel proffer the questions and expected answers they would have gotten had cross-examination been extended?
Well, Mr. Smith actually attempted to proffer it, and I included that portion of the record in the brief, and Mr. Click, who was the attorney for the opposing litigant, objected to the proffer, and the judge in that court said, well, I can't accept the proffer if the other side's going to agree to it. But I will maintain that I don't think the proffer was necessary in this case, and in fact, that's the exact circumstance that arose in Campbell versus Campbell. Because in Campbell versus Campbell, the litigant there did not proffer what was supposed to be said for cross-examination.
Well, Campbell versus Campbell, as I recall, if I'm recalling it correctly, it's been a while, cross-examination was cut off with an arbitrary time limit. In other words, you know, the clock hit 12 and the judge said, that's it. And we held, I think, that the arbitrary nature of the judge's ruling was error. But we always have to we're required by statute to always do a harmless error analysis. And it seems to be here, as Judge Alston just pointed out, that wasn't quite the case. The judge provided some latitude, and then, you know, obviously the judge has the discretion to cut off evidence that's cumulative or inadmissible, you know, in some fashion. Mm-hmm. So the question is, where do we draw the line?
Well, it seems
to me, in terms of error, you have to demonstrate that it's reversible error through a proffer of what the questions and expected answers would have been, or at least what the area of questioning would have been, it would seem to me.
Well, again, I think it's covered, and it's in the brief very specifically, that portion of the error where that trial attorney did attempt to proffer the record and was refused by the judge and was not allowed to proffer. So where he attempted to proffer and was not allowed to proffer, I don't think we can now hold that attorney or this appellant at fault, because that proffer was not able to be made when that trial attorney tried to make the proffer.
Isn't Campbell a little different here? Because as Judge Humphreys has pointed out, there was an arbitrary time limit set in Campbell. And in this case, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the time for presenting this case had been requested and set on June 16th. In other words, there was a finite amount of time that was set for the adjudication of the matter, not 2 days, not 3 days. A specific amount of time was set for the trying of this case, and the judge worked within the confines, as had been agreed by counsel, on the June 16th date, didn't he?
Well, that's exactly what happened in Campbell versus Campbell. The two attorneys agreed to set the trial for 4 days period of time, and what happened in Campbell versus Campbell, after the attorneys made that agreement, sure enough, they get into trial, and Dad runs out of time. I believe Dad was the appellant in that case. And so when he ran out of time, he was then not allowed to cross-examine his remaining two witnesses. And when he was not allowed to cross-examine his remaining two witnesses, the wife, the mother, made that same exact thing. Hey, he used his time.
But the trial judge here was pretty clear in making sure that both counsel were aware of how the time was running. And specifically said, counsel, you're using a lot of your time here. You're implicating your ability to cross-examine. Potentially, I'm not going to tell you how to run your case, but I'm just letting you know that you're bumping up against time that you might otherwise use in a more important area. So the judge was trying to encourage counsel to stay within the confines of the time that the counsel had agreed to.
Well, I think he did start that at 15 minutes prior, based on my reading of the record, and then again at 12 minutes prior, and then again at 2 minutes prior. However, the problem is the right to cross-examine is fundamental, and therefore it is the only way to do a search for the truth when you're talking about
a trial. Well, it's fundamental, but it's not unlimited. I mean, you have to stay within the scope of direct, for example, and if you're going to stray outside the scope of direct, then it's perfectly proper to cut off cross-examination, just as one example.
Absolutely.
So
also,
how do we know that that wasn't done here?
Well, in another example, for example, if it's not relevant in evidence, then the judge certainly could say, no, you can't do that. If it's not admissible into evidence, the judge can say, no, you can't do that. But here, this had nothing to do with the rules of evidence. And Campbell made it very clear that the judge certainly has the discretion to cut off the cross-examination when it comes to the rules of evidence.
Ms. Wilson, you're experienced counsel, and I understand what you're saying. I'm trying to work my way to where you want to get us to. Suppose, for instance, parties had agreed that they wanted to put some condemning lighting matter on a 30-minute docket, and that happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And the judge says, okay, you put it on a 30-minute docket, but there is the option to put it on a longer docket. Typically, if you get on the 30-minute docket, you get into court quicker. But if you want a three-hour time frame, you might have to wait a while. Counsel makes the decision, okay, I'm going to go ahead and go on this 30-minute docket. I'm going to do what I need to do. And suppose it's an important issue, spousal support or whatever. You get on the 30-minute docket, and the judge says, okay, everybody has 15 minutes. And so one side uses up all of their 15 minutes. And then when it's time to cross-examine the other side, they say, Judge, I want to cross-examine. And the judge says, you put it on the pending lighting docket. This is a 30-minute docket. You've used your time. I'm not going to give you any opportunity for cross-examination. Would that be wrong?
Well, I've been in cases involved like that, unfortunately. And
well, what happens
inevitably in those cases, the judge goes, we're clearly not going to have enough time to finish this day. Okay, let's all get our calendars out. We're going to look for another date. And that's how it's usually dealt with. Fortunately for me, knock on wood, I haven't had to deal with a case yet where a judge has gone, 30 minutes, you're done, I'm making my decision. Most judges want to get the decision right, and they recognize if there's not enough time. And ultimately, that's what this case boils down to. We've got this little situation.
But my struggle is that this is the time frame that counsel had agreed to.
And that's exactly what happened in Campbell versus Campbell. And in that case, counsel had agreed to a four-day trial. And I think Mr. Smith said on the record, which I placed in the brief, that he was relatively new to the case. He wasn't quite sure what the case involved. It turned out the case involved 15 witnesses and five experts. When he got into that, and then father didn't comply with the deadlines for discovery.
Does that create a due process violation on the part of the judge?
Well, no, it doesn't. But the problem comes in is when then Mr. Smith made his motion for continuance. Certainly, and we can get into that argument now, when he made his motion for continuance, the judge denied the motion on an improper basis. Mainly that the judge said that you have to let the guardian ad litem determine custody, or not custody, but visitation if you want this continuance. Hey, I'll move it to another date. I'll give you the time that you need,
but
that you're asking
like
for.
It wasn't like a permanent, as court has noted, you can't do that permanently. But mm-hmm. this was a temporary decision on visitation.
That's correct.
Right.
But it doesn't matter because, as this court is well aware, sometimes these cases go on for years. So let's say mother had agreed to let this guardian ad litem determine visitation, which she absolutely did not. She strongly objected to and said, hey, guardian ad litem, you know, can't determine custody and visitation. You two were the judges on the panel who decided that case. And the problem is the judge then used that basis to say, no, I'm not going to grant this continuance. Well, the truth is sometimes these cases can be continued for 2 years. And that's exactly what happened in Gregory versus Martin, which was a court of appeals case before this court. Well, so are we saying just because it's a temporary order that goes on for 2 years that that's okay to let a guardian ad litem determine? Well, I would say no, because there's still
How long
no...
How was it here, though? We weren't talking about anything like a year or two, were we? I mean, he was just trying to reach some brief finality, wasn't he?
But we have no idea how long it would have taken because the date hadn't been scheduled. Yeah, right. So it could have been 2 years. It could have been 5 years. It could have been, I mean, when you get into these contentious custody cases, they go on for years. They do. And
But again, I'm struggling. A judge has responsibility to manage his or her docket.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge has a situation where things are brought before the judge. And the judge says, people say, okay, after telling you this is how much time we need, we actually need more time. I want a continuance. The judge is sitting there thinking, okay, we've got a child involved, mm-hmm. and so I need to do something with this child in the interim to do the best I can to maintain the status quo. I'm not going to hear any evidence as to what is in the best interest of this child. The guardian has a more involved circumstance with this child. So what I'm going to suggest to trial judge is if you all want a continuance, in the interim we're going to let the guardian deal with the issue of child support visitation, whatever. Not child support, but visitation, so that we can actually keep this case in a circumstance where ultimately I will be able to make a call on the case. Parties listen to the offer as to how we're going to facilitate resolution of a new issue that's been brought to the court's attention. One of the parties objects. Judge does what he should have said. Okay, since you're not going to agree to it, Court of Appeals has told me I can't order this, mm-hmm. so we're going to go forward.
Well, the problem is that...
Please answer his question, but I want to let you know you are going into your rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. The problem we have is there was already a status quo. The JNDR court had issued an order for JNDR of custody and visitation. So there was already an order in place that was put in place by a judge, and that would have been the order had the case continued. So there was a status quo. By allowing a third party who is not a judge, then we're now abdicating the judge's duty to determine custody and visitation. As this court has already now decided in two cases where all three of you have sat on those panels for this one or the other case. So therefore, when the judge asked her to abdicate its duty to determine this visitation, then that's where we run into the problems because you're basically asking for mother to commit to something that's contrary to law just to be able to have her due process rights. I'm going to save my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Good morning, Ms. Coleman.
May it please the court, my name is Lauren Cardell. I'm with the firm of Jacobs, Cardell & Gill. I have been in practice for many years, but my last time here, I believe, was about 20 years ago. So it's nice to be
back.
Nice
to be back.
Thank
you. Welcome
back.
Judge Humphreys was here, none of the rest.
I hate to admit my age.
I think I was going to die sort of let me ask you, pick up where your opponent left off. The judge here delegated to you the authority to set basically visitation, custody visitation parameters. Mm-hmm. Why isn't that error as a matter of law? The code clearly provides that as being the responsibility for the court.
Well,
we certainly have frowned on the court delegating that, certainly the criminal area with probation officers and here in the domestic relations area to GALs.
And Judge, I believe it is not error, and here is the reason why. The case law is specific in that the court, in this situation, the court was asking me to set an interim schedule for a brief period
of
time.
Well, the role of a guardian ad litem is, as an officer of the court, is to advise the court and make certain recommendations.
That's correct.
You certainly are free to do that, but it's the court's obligation to actually decide whether to accept or reject those recommendations and make the ultimate determination. Now, not having heard a single recommendation, basically delegating the entire authority to you, and I'm not singling you out, any guardian ad litem, that clearly is not what the black letter law, of 20.1 says.
Well, and Judge, I believe that the difference in this situation is that the court shall not leave in the discretion of a third party to set visitation after there's been a trial on the merits of the case. And so we have a situation here where I had served as guardian ad litem throughout the juvenile court proceedings, which had gone on for a very prolonged period of time. This case was set for trial on June 6th.
Well, had Judge Harris turned to you and said, Ms. Cadell, do you have a recommendation as to custody visitation pending this continuance? And you had given a recommendation, the court said, so ordered, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
But I agree.
Isn't what happened.
I agree, Judge, because this wasn't even truly a hearing. There was a telephone conference which had taken place. And it was a telephone conference in which there was a request for a continuance of the matter. And there was an objection to the continuance of the matter. And when the court asked for and if I have my timeline correct, I believe I actually had submitted a letter for that conference because I had to be in another court to try a case. And I had explained that my concerns at that point were the effects on this child of things that had happened since the juvenile court had put the order in place and the effects that such a continuance would have not being in the best interest of the child. And that is why the court at that point, Your Honor, and I think it comes back to whether the court abused its discretion. I think the primary issue is did the court abuse its discretion in denying the continuance to begin with. I think the court has the authority.
Well, that's a different issue, but I think the objection is the court's error is conditioning the continuance upon doing whatever you say, essentially, with respect to custody and visitation, and not making the decision independently as the Code of Virginia requires the court to do.
I agree, Judge, and I think, again, in this situation, it's a secondary issue because the court had the discretion to say there's going to be a continuance or not a continuance on whatever grounds he feels that those were appropriate unless he's abused his discretion in doing so. And I don't believe he abused his discretion in saying, in the best interest of this child, if things need to be changed in the interim, I will agree to the continuance, but first and foremost, we need to do what's in the best interest of this child. And if prolonging this case...
How long is the interim here that you're...
I am happy to answer that question, Judge. The Henrico Circuit Court sets cases on Monday, contested cases, on Monday of every week. So it's just a matter of how long the court's dockets are backed up. In a typical situation, here we had a day set, which is truly in excess of what most of these cases are set for. Most of these cases are anywhere from 2 hours to a half day. Counsel asked for the day. You can see that it was from June to September in order to get that day set. So now what counsel was asking for was basically 2 days or something in excess of 1 day. So I think that you can take from the record that what we'd be looking at is anywhere from 3 to, at most, perhaps 5 or 6 months for the continuance of that case. It's just a matter of the availability on the court's docket, but there is nothing in the record that would suggest that it would be anywhere near what counsel for the appellant is arguing of years. That does not...
So your answer is you're guessing 3 to 6 months based on...
At most, Judge.
Unless there are more continuances requested and granted.
That's correct, Judge. And I will tell you that continuances typically aren't granted. The law holds that these matters need to be tried as quickly as possible because it's the best interest of a child that we're looking at. I would also like to point out, Your Honors, that
counsel repeatedly throughout her appellate initial brief and reply brief misconstrues what the issues are in this case to begin with. She repeatedly cites that this is a termination of her client's parental rights. And she cites law throughout her brief that supports that. The case law that she states is all dealing with true parental right termination cases.
This isn't a termination case.
It is not, Judge. It is a custody and visitation case that comes under 20-124.
But I think what she's suggesting, even though I think we all agree that it's not a termination case, I think the thrust of her argument is that the principles that would adhere in a termination case in the context of this case may be applicable here.
But Judge, I don't believe that that is accurate, because she cites unfitness of a parent, which really is not one of the factors under, I mean, we have to look at 20-124.3, and that's what the court did in a full day trial here, in which they took into consideration the testimony of the witnesses that were called. What I find especially interesting in this case is that Judge Harris did repeatedly throughout the case remind everybody, this is the time that you have left. Counsel for appellant not only used up his time, but used up the time in a manner that was really primarily, as the record shows, to refute the report submitted by Dr. Curry King. The factors that the court had to take into consideration under 20-124 really were very, very barely addressed by counsel for the appellant at all. Almost every witness that was called on her behalf dealt with trying to refute the report of the independent evaluator in the case. And so at the point, going back to the Campbell v. Campbell case, at the point that counsel then runs out of time, the court did not prohibit him, as the court certainly had the jurisdiction and the ability to do, to say, you've run out of time.
I think it's jurisdiction, I think it's the authority.
Authority, I apologize, Judge, you are correct. The authority to do, instead he did give him latitude to do that. And that is the concern in this case, was really how the counsel decided to set their time. The judge does have the discretion to set a docket. And under what the appellant is arguing in this situation, we would be in a situation where the court really could never docket cases in any type of timely fashion, because if the court sets it for 1 hour or 2 hours or 4 hours, and a party has the unlimited right to go on with cross-examination and calling every witness despite the time limits that have been put in place, we then can't have cases heard in a timely manner.
You were involved, obviously, with the Garnet Latham in the case while it was at the trial level.
That's correct.
As a person was able to observe and listen to all the testimony, was any of the testimony from these witnesses that were called duplicative or repetitive?
The witnesses called by the appellant,
yes.
Your Honor? Yes. And again, the focus, when I say yes, it's because the focus was on the refuting of the data in Dr. King's report. So Dr. King did a very thorough independent evaluation to determine custody. It was an independent custody evaluation. And so testing data was run psychologically, as well as parent-child observations and assessments. And he set forth a very detailed written report, which interestingly was stipulated and allowed to come into evidence by the appellant. Appellant then doesn't call Dr. King to testify to refute the report, but instead brings forth a number of other witnesses who have never met with the child, who have never done any of the same testing on the parties or observations of the parties with the child, and yet they come into court to try to refute the technical data. And that's where the focus of the appellant's case was before Judge Harris that day, and that's what Judge Harris takes exception with when he says things such as, if this is how you are choosing to use your time, basically so be it. But pointing out that he really was not addressing any of the factors that the court had to take into consideration in making a determination about what was in the best interest of this child.
Talk to us a little more, Ms. Wilson did, about Campbell versus Campbell. Talk to us a little more yourself about Campbell versus Campbell. As you just noted, it's a four-day trial.
That's
this
right.
It was a one-day trial. Yet this court held, as it did in Campbell, what's the difference?
Well, the difference, I believe, Judge, in regards to whether it's a four-day trial or a one-day trial, The difference in Campbell is in Campbell, the court prohibited cross-examination. Your time is up, and you're not allowed to ask any questions. I think the distinguishing factor here is that Judge Harris very clearly said, you have exhausted your time, despite that I'm going to allow you 15 minutes to cross-examine the witnesses. So he did not prohibit the cross-examination. He allowed it to happen just in a limited fashion.
No witnesses were not cross-examined. There was just a limit on the time.
That's correct, Judge.
Unlike in Campbell, where two witnesses were not cross-examined
at all. That is correct. That is correct. And I think in Campbell they also make reference, Your Honor, to the fact that it is the discussion of you cannot predict how much time an adverse witness will take in their testimony. In this situation, that's very easily distinguished because these were not any adverse witnesses that the appellant had called. They were his witnesses. He set his trial strategy. He set his own calendar or his own agenda or schedule for how he was going to present his own witnesses. And again, that's how he chose to present his case. There were no adverse witnesses who were testifying. There are no further questions.
Further questions from Ms. Cotto?
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Ms. Wilson, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me help you on this. This from my perspective, I can't speak for either Judge Beals or Judge Humphreys, but it seems to me that the best argument you have probably relates to the denial of the continuance. That's, from my perspective, that's the best argument you have, because when you get into the discretion of the trial court with regard to managing his or her own docket, that's going to be a tough road for you to overcome. So the best issue for you is whether or not the court conditioning the GAL's recommendation on custody and visitation in the interim was undermining your client's ability to, and conditioning that on the granting of the continuance, undermine your client's ability to put on the best case. Now, obviously, if you abdicate the responsibility as a trial judge to the GAL to make the determination of custody and visitation, we've said in no uncertain terms, that's wrong, you cannot do that. But why doesn't a trial judge have the ability to offer a preliminary resolution to the parties? If they accept it, and if the parties don't accept it, then we move on. Why can't the court do that?
Well, it's the same thing. I think the example I used in my brief was, hey, if the judge said, if you go rob that bank over there, I'll give you a continuance, you're good. You can't say, hey, if you do this thing that's contrary to law and agree to that, then yes, I will grant you your continuance. As the Supreme Court has stated, an abuse of discretion is by definition when a court commits an error of law. And the court clearly committed an error of law by asking the mother to agree to an unlawful act, which in this case...
I don't think it's asking, offering. That's a little different.
Well, but it's still the same thing. The judge is basically saying, here, I've got time on the docket, I will give you, but only if you commit this illegal act. And if not, I'm not giving you that. Here's the bottom line to this case.
But let's take away the go rob a bank. That's the extreme circumstance. Let's talk about practical things. Don't parties always, in the context of preparing cases, agree to things that the court may not otherwise be allowed to do? For instance, suppose in a Pendennis-Leidy case, the parties say, okay, I'm the father, you're the mother, even though I don't have an obligation to pay college expenses, I will continue to pay college expenses until this case is resolved. Judge can't order the father or the mother to do that, but the parties can agree to do that.
That's correct, but in many cases, if it's contrary...
Answer Judge Alston's question. I've let you go well over your time, but please answer his question, then you'll need to wrap up.
Yes, absolutely, that's correct. But the problem you've got is when it's contrary to law, they don't have to agree to that. And in many cases, courts don't even have to approve the agreement if it's contrary to law. And a primary case is the case that you two just sat on, well, not just sat on, it seems like just, Riley versus Riley, where you guys said, hey, it was error for that judge to approve the language in the consent order, the quote-unquote consent order that mother objected to, because they shouldn't have said third parties could determine this custody and visitation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. We will recounsel, and then the next case on our docket is Carol R. Montgomery.